You're listening to a podcast produced by the Jackson School of International Studies, the Center for West European Studies, and the European Union Center at the University of Washington. This and other podcasts can be found on iTunes and SoundCloud. For more information, visit us at jsis.washington.edu/EU West Europe.
Much as Ryan likes cartoons, I like maps. I'm all about maps. We're gonna have nothing but maps here. And it's not quite, I wouldn't necessarily argue that geography is destiny, but it's a big piece of it. When you talk about the true underlying priorities of governments and countries, just inherently, if you knew nothing else about the politics, you can say that Portugal has a very different interest than Greece, has a very different interest than Denmark, has a very different interest than Norway, right? It has to be. It almost doesn't matter who lives there, and it almost doesn't matter what's going on politically. The geography ends up being defining. So this is an old map. This is a map showing NATO, non-aligned countries, or neutrals, depending on where you're talking about, and the Warsaw Pact. And I think whenever we're talking about modern European defense, we just have to remember that this is sort of the post-World War II Cold War universe. And in particular, I'd like to note how many of the countries we'll be talking about all day don't exist on this map. Unified Yugoslavia, integrated Baltics, just part of the Soviet Union. It's very easy when we look at a modern map to forget how recently this was the map, right? Divided Germany, right? It's one of my favorite things is actually to run through on YouTube. There's a fantastic time lapse of European borders over the last 1,000 years. And what's interesting is, you know, looking at the changes and through the Napoleonic Wars and through the 30 Years' War and the 100 Years' War, and then realizing that those changes keep rolling through the Second World War and through the end of the Cold War. And there's just as much change in European borders now as there ever has been historically. We've had a couple blocks of relative stability, but that's, you know, a punctuated equilibrium like we talk about in biological evolution, right? It's not like this. We tend to have plateaus and peaks when things change. So, complicated background. What do we need to know about NATO? NATO's founded in 1949. We're not going to go deep into the background and the history of that. We'll talk a little bit about NATO's pattern of expansion. The things I would really like you to walk away with: currently 31 member states, presumably 32 soon as Sweden's allowed to join. Notably, two of those countries are North American, US and Canada, key members. Three are nuclear powers and also UN Security Council permanent members, US, UK, and France. 10 are former Warsaw Pact members. And this expansion eastward of NATO into, not just into the Warsaw Pact, but almost all of what was the Warsaw Pact other than the Soviet Union, and in fact parts of what used to be the Soviet Union. Four NATO members are former Yugoslav republics, back to things that didn't exist in that first map. The most recent is North Macedonia, joining in March 2020. If I ever end up, I don't have a PhD, but if I ever did write a PhD dissertation, it would probably be on major international treaties scuttled by France. And so I'll just note that, you know, throughout this, anytime we talk about NATO as a unified entity, please remember France is a special case. for much of the Cold War under the Gallo-Mitterrandist policy. They were not part of NATO's military alliance, although they remained part of the political alliance. And they joined and rejoined and unjoined the policy committee, and then they rejoined and then it went away a year later. Anyway, you don't need to know the details of that, but you should just keep in mind that France's participation and level of engagement is weirdly mobile over time for one of the major countries and a UN Security Council member and a nuclear power at the absolute heart of NATO, right? So France is an interesting and sometimes very challenging case. You've all seen and you all know, I'm sure, NATO's Article 5 is the article under which members have agreed to a common defense. Do you know the one time it's been invoked? Ever? Historically? Article 5 invoked one time.
9/11.
Yep. September 12th, 2001. So the only time Article 5 has ever been invoked in common defense was in defense of the United States, which is kind of an interesting historical side note. NATO is often described as the most successful military alliance in history. And that's arguable. History is a big place. There's a lot going on. But NATO succeeded in its primary mission of defending Western Europe against the Warsaw Pact without ever firing a shot in anger. NATO fired its very, very first live round outside of its own area in former Yugoslavia over Bosnia in 1994. That becomes a really interesting conversation when you talk about alternatives to NATO or a parallel entity towards NATO. What do you set up to compete with, contend with, pull away from, alternativize, if you like that word, the most successful military alliance in history? How do you do that? Should you do that? What are the costs, right? Complex. Part of the end of the Cold War for NATO was an authorization for out-of-area operations. Originally, NATO was defined as entirely a defensive alliance intended to fight exclusively on its own territory, the territory of its own members, or into the space of someone who is directly attacking them. And NATO needed to change its charter to allow out-of-area operations to have a wider security role in the post-Cold War era. And since then, NATO has taken on some complex security tasks. Yugoslavia, former Yugoslavia, the Yugoslav Wars, key number one. They also did a ton of work in Afghanistan, anti-piracy more recently. They took over the Libya mission. If you're interested, we can talk about that. It's an interesting episode of individual European states trying to take on a security activity that lasted 3 days before it became clear that the individual countries involved weren't really ready to take on that big a load, and it became a NATO process, right? Sorry?
That's
not right. Okay.
But anyway,
we can move on.
I worked.
Okay. NATO hasn't been super active in Syria, although several members are active individually. Just NATO's evolution, starting with the dark blue here, the original countries, expanding further eastward. We've got nice and fresh Finland joining in. We're not going to talk a ton about Turkey today, but it's an interesting and challenging aspect of the NATO alliance. Turkey has, by and large, over the history of the Cold War, been a good partner and a good member and kind of a linchpin of the southern flank. Obviously, in recent years, with changes in government, there's been more conflict and challenge there, and now Turkey is actively holding up Sweden's membership. The U.S. has sanctioned Turkey about the F-35 and S-400 missile deal. So there's some complexity in that relationship. We could talk about that for the full hour without any difficulty. It's just worth noting that Turkey, almost every time it comes up, is a special case, right? This is a very old quote. It's from the first NATO Secretary General, and it's an interesting question whether it's still relevant, right? What is NATO for? NATO is for, its purpose is to keep the Soviet Union out, the Americans in, and the Germans down. And what's interesting, still today, there are, these end up being relevant questions. Soviet Union's gone, but Russian military expeditionary issues are real and live today. Keeping the Americans in, involved, engaged, participant in European defense, still a live question. And yeah, how much that should be and what the alternatives are, a question today. And the Germans down, arguably that one's just been lost, right? That game's done. I guess I'm starting to sound a little bit like Dr. McCoy from Star Trek about all the things we're not talking about today. You know, I'm not a veterinarian. We're not talking about Turkey, and we're not really talking about Germany and the EU. An interesting question is to what extent the EU represents a sort of German-Franco alliance economically driving Europe on a larger scale, right? So two of those three still live. The Germans are a really interesting place in the security situation. You don't need to have a close look at this. It's not really meant for you to read. You can look at the slide whenever you want. But what I want you to take away, I'm going to be talking all day about the European Union. And today, that's a unified, well-understood political-military foreign policy entity with a strong economic aspect. But particularly when we're talking historically, it's important to remember that the pathway to get there, to today's unified vertical bar representing EU and its institutions, it's been more complicated than that. And so I'll probably just say EU for simplicity, but depending on when in history we're talking about, we might also be talking about the entities known as the European Community or the European Communities, and the European Economic Community. It's notable that right down here at the bottom, since we're talking about defense, is the Western European Union, the WEU, which was the institution technically responsible for the European side of defense, including European participation in NATO. It's worth noting that when you pull up the Wikipedia page for the Western European Union, it has a timeline. And what it says is 1952 to 1984, largely dormant. Largely dormant is the heading for that entire institutional piece of what becomes the EU. Because the EU wasn't primarily a defense entity. NATO had that covered. It was clear there's defense aspects and security aspects, and to your question, foreign policy aspects. But what the EU is really focused on is all this stuff up here, European Coal and Steel Community, Economic Community, Schengen, Justice and Home Affairs, common foreign security policy exists, but it's not really at the core of what the EU thinks of itself as. We'll talk about that evolution a little bit along the way. As the EU is growing in integration, we're also growing in membership. From the original six countries to 12, to 15, eventually to 28, now with the UK departed down to 27, new candidate members. What I'd like you to take away is that we talk today about the EU as one thing that we understand well and is comprehensive, or nearly so, across the European continent. But its history is this one of deepening and increasing its areas of engagement, broadening geographically. And particularly when we're talking about things like defense policy, this question of at what point has the EU become large enough geographically and integrated enough in terms of its areas of competency that defense becomes a major issue for which they're responsible. It's always been on the table. There's always a line up there for it. But somewhere over here, way to the right side of this graph, pick a place, you hit a point where defense really needed to become something that the EU was taking seriously, that they considered as part of their core competency. But what day was that? And who's really responsible for it? We'll talk about who's responsible for it in a minute. And who thinks that's their main job every day? Kind of a more complicated question. So this is a current NATO membership map. And it highlights some interesting pieces, right? A solid wall of nice dark blue with some interesting gaps. Neutrals. Ireland, Switzerland, Austria. A year or two ago, all this would have been showing neutral also, right? What fantastic foreign policy Vladimir Putin has brought about that's caused Sweden, in particular, to drop its centuries-long policy of neutrality, right? How's that going? Anyway, what I want you to take from this map is, while in many ways NATO really is a clearly unified entity, the geography is still really challenging, right? There are countries that are not members. There's a group of members here in the Baltics, we'll talk more about that this afternoon, because we'll be talking a lot about it, who are kind of hanging off the side here. They maybe feel a little lonely, they maybe feel a little isolated. Are they really confident? Are you really, really sure, if you're Lithuania or Latvia or Estonia, that Germany or France are ready to drive divisions up through Poland in your defense today? Are you ready to bet your life on it? How sure are you that NATO's really coming? Right now, today, the odds for that actually look better than they have for years. NATO is uniquely unified today. How deep is that? Maybe TBD, right? And there are two or three places in the world that I think we could identify as the most dangerous place in the world right now. Several of them are in the South China Sea, but I'll just point out the Kaliningrad enclave, which is Russia. It's a chunk of Russia, geographically separated, an exclave if you prefer. The trains from here run sealed, so there are no border checks. They just run from Russia into Kaliningrad. It's a military base. It's a base for surface-to-air missiles. It's a base for naval vessels. It is chock full of ethnic Russians who were shipped there during the Soviet era, and military retirees who think it's a better place to be than other choices. And if you were going to look for a place that seemed likely over pick an amount of time to end up being a cause for war or a cause for a Russian move through NATO territory, Kaliningrad kind of has to be at the top of the list. What's the real world risk of that? 5 or 10 years ago, we might have said pretty low. When you look at Russia's history of trumping through other countries for their political needs in the last decade, it's hard to be sanguine about what's going on or what might be going on with Kaliningrad. So just, you know, dangerous spots in the world, this axis right here. I'm not even going to get into Belarusia. It's its own set of challenges. Here's the EU map. Very similar, right? Candidate members, possible growth. We're not really going to talk about it today, but Western Balkan accession to the EU, the candidacy of the Western Balkan states, is a huge and ongoing problem. Ukraine has been offered candidate membership. But what does that really mean? Are they going to jump ahead of the Western Balkan states who've been candidates for some time? Almost certainly not. Under what sort of circumstances might Ukraine be stable enough to actually fully join the EU as a member? Undetermined. The EU has used expansion and growth and joining the EU as its most powerful foreign policy tool for decades now, kind of to your original question there. The EU tends to be about integrated power, relatively soft power, economic power. And you could make a strong argument, I guess I would make the strong argument, that the accession, the joining of this entire swath of Eastern Europe is one of the most powerful economic and political stabilization policies of the last 50 years. Rather than having Eastern Europe split off from the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union, become a rough and tumble mix of complex governments and differing priorities, the EU really stretched to bring those countries in, stabilize their neighborhood, change the future of those nations, and incidentally opened huge new markets for their companies. Right, so what I'd like you to take away from this is the EU's leaning away from sort of military power, in part because NATO has handled that, and towards economic, integrative, government stabilization. A lot of this kind of really ugly, hard stuff that nobody wants to do, going through and rewriting the constitutions of member countries to align with European Union regulations, is an incredibly hard and frustrating and slow and tedious job. And the EU is absolutely up for hard and frustrating and tedious jobs, right? That's kind of their jam. You know, they're much less interested in sort of showy deployments to, you know, drop in and create peace in a conflict zone. They'd much rather go through and retrain your police, prosecutors, and judges over the course of 20 years, right? That's their thing. I'll just note Turkey, they're in red. They've been a candidate of the European Union since 1987. Their negotiations are frozen as a sanction for human rights violations. This is, I think you have to argue, a failure of the growth and outreach policy. The idea was that by offering Turkey membership, it would help pull them in, it would help align them to the West, it would help align their governance with more democratic principles, and that's clearly not how it ended up playing out. But we're stuck in a catch-22. The EU can't terminate Turkey's membership application. They can't terminate their candidacy. That's a major insult, right? That says you're not now and you never will be ready for membership. Can't move it forward with a backsliding from democratic principles to whatever extent they were there in the first place government with, right, I mean, we can list Turkey's problems, human rights violations, and. So if we can't go back and we can't go forward, they're just frozen. And that's likely to be where it stays for a considerable amount of time. What might happen with that? Like some of these other things I'm going to talk about today, there just isn't an obvious pathway out. How do you move forward? I don't even have a good idea. In some ways, this is the most important slide I'm going to show you today. And it's the overlap between NATO and the EU. From a US perspective, it's really easy to identify these both as relatively comprehensive European institutions that have almost all European countries involved. But that's not the case. And there's a couple places where it's really, really critical. EU members who are not NATO members, five, presumably soon to be four, Austria and Ireland, true neutrals. Ireland in particular is an aggressively neutral state. Malta, small, hardly matters in this context. Cyprus, actually I love Malta. If you haven't been to Malta, go to Malta. Cyprus is a huge problem in which the northern third, roughly, of the island is still militarily occupied by Turkey, which oddly is one of the smallest problems in Turkey's EU membership candidacy, is that they are militarily occupying the territory of an existing EU member. That was supposed to be solved as part of Cyprus joining. It didn't happen. It's a fascinating study if you ever want to dig into that on what happens when you have two parallel processes that are supposed to be happening in step, and then they get out of step, and they're like, well, this one's looking really good. I'm sure it'll be fine. Didn't end up getting fixed. And then the other challenging... NATO members who are not EU members. UK is a big recent addition to this list, obviously. And one of the real challenges for European defense is that the UK was not necessarily the largest, although one of the most active and comprehensive, in American terms, full spectrum militaries in Europe, but for sure the one most closely aligned and ready to interoperate with the US on a day-to-day basis in modern American, you know, American or NATO style, depending on how you want to look at it, network warfare. The UK has been absolutely the closest daily participant with US forces, the most ready, just on your average Tuesday, to go fight alongside American troops in a deployed global atmosphere. We're not going to dig deep into it. You know, France has an amazingly capable military, and they do interoperate heavily with NATO, and they're probably the next closest, but in part because of this sort of "we're France" approach, which is not unreasonable. I don't mean to be giving them a hard time for that. They've stood a little bit more parallel to the American global engagement than the UK has. So having the UK out is a big change. Norway, Croatia, Montenegro, Albania, Turkey, and on the bottom of this list, the US and Canada, NATO members who are not EU members, right? Just worth calling out. It's been very clear for a long time that the EU has needed to step up on their ownership of European defense. How does that work in the context of the most successful military alliance in history that's heavily US driven? Not to say US dominated, although that has been true at various points in NATO's history. US military spending accounts for about 70% of NATO's total spending. That's a little bit of a misleading statistic because that covers all US defense spending, whereas other NATO countries, all of their spending is dedicated towards European defense, whereas the US number is a global number, right? But the US has leaned heavily on our ability to pivot and to bring forces to Europe if needed. And so I think a good number to imagine sort of what the US brings in terms of funding and capability for NATO is about half. What's interesting, no, go ahead. No, so if you have a different number in mind.
Way more.
Well, so here's the point I was getting to, is if you look at allocation of forces, if you look at budgets, the half number stands. In terms of effectiveness, deployable forces, and in particular what the US military, you know, we describe as the kill chain, right? This process from intelligence to consolidation to actual action and the ability to go do that in the field, the vast majority of that is reliant on US skills, equipment, military, and resources. And so if we're picking a number in terms of actual military effectiveness brought to the table by the US side of the process, you end up with a number wildly higher. Right, so you were correct that I was sort of throwing out a straw man there. I didn't mean to freak you out. And so what we have today is a NATO, you know, if you sort of imagine, if I like the idea of a potluck, if you're bringing food to a potluck and you're bringing half the food to the potluck, and other people are bringing one dish apiece,
you're the host.
You're the host, right? You're defining the tone. And so for our European allies, who are still mostly operating as national militaries, this question of what do you bring to the table? Are you attempting to bring a full spectrum nuclear military with a globally deployable navy, cargo planes that are able to deploy thousands of miles outside your area, amphibious landing ships that could pull up off somebody's coast and send even a small group ashore for humanitarian intervention or military intervention? Well, that's a pretty big ask. The number of countries that are really prepared to be full-spectrum global militaries is really small. In a European context, we're really talking about the UK and France. Yeah. Oh, sorry. We're really talking about the UK and France. And then other countries have to make some decisions about what they're going to do. Are you going to specialize? Are you going to be the country that brings minesweepers? You know, half your Navy turns out to be minesweepers. And when NATO needs minesweepers, they call you up and say, hey, we need your minesweepers. Or you want to specialize in airfield defense forces. And when NATO needs somebody to drop on an airfield and defend it, that's your specialty, right? So this question of full spectrum versus relatively specialized capabilities or some mix, every country's got to make a call about how they're going to do that and how they're going to spend their defense budget. Should you be, if you're Poland, should you be a heavily anti-tank and artillery-oriented force ready to take on Russian divisions coming across your border with fully integrated air defense? Well, maybe that's a priority. How about if you're Denmark? light deployable, crisis intervention forces, heavy on the air defense, and maybe heavy on anti-ship missiles, and the ability for sort of mid-level naval engagement. Where do you put your money? How much influence does NATO have in those choices? Are NATO's priorities different than the EU priorities if EU is pushing defense forward? How do you balance that? None of these have good answers, right? Countries and the alliances have to make their choices and try to figure out how to get to something that's workable for what they're trying to accomplish. I'm just going to bounce over the Yugoslav wars. Other than to note that this is sort of a pivotal time. Fall of the Soviet Union, transition of NATO out of Cold War mode and into a more neighborhood and out of area intervention mode. An opportunity for European countries to step forward for a huge, huge problem happening in their immediate neighborhood. You know, if you've driven from Munich into former Yugoslavia, it's a few hours, right? It's right there. And one of the things that came out of that was the extent to which there was not a European consensus, at least at the beginning of this process, about how to respond and how to engage effectively. So this question of European defense identity, what is a European defense identity? How does it exist separate from NATO, parallel with NATO, intertwined with NATO? And the traditional three Ds articulated in 1998 by Madeleine Albright have been kind of a cornerstone of that conversation, and they're problematic. Right? No duplication of things NATO's doing well. Well, if NATO's the most successful defense alliance in the history of defense alliances, and you're trying to create a separate defense identity, how could you possibly do that without duplicating things NATO's already doing well? And so it's an interesting question. You know, you were asking about the military-industrial complex in the US. You know, I would argue, and John may have other thoughts about this on the way, that the U.S. is deeply ambivalent about the concept of a separate European defense identity. In some sense, we very much like them to pick up the slack and kind of take some ownership and free up some of the U.S. defense umbrella. And the idea of strategic independence, where they can just do whatever they want without checking with us, is also deeply unattractive. And how those balance out, I think, varies deeply by who you talk to, the administration, the time frame, the topic. I would not argue that the sort of U.S. is actively trying to keep the European defense industry down. They're quite capable. The stuff they make is excellent. But the fragmentation and, you know, the tradition in European defense programs is that three or four countries, Germany, Italy, and Spain, for example, decide to develop a new air-to-air missile or a new surface-to-air frigate. And halfway through the program, one of them decides that this committee-based joint design doesn't really meet their needs, and they break off and go buy something different. And so what is, in fact, a fairly powerful and effective defense industry ends up being deeply fragmented in terms of what they're buying, deploying, et cetera. And we don't need to get into the question of sort of all of these smart missiles and smart weapons are produced in the thousands a year category. You know, Apple makes 100 million iPhones a year, but making 5,000 surface-to-air missiles in a single year would be an extraordinary goal, and maybe at the heart of a procurement program. You know, it's not quite like these things are individually hand-whittled by Black Forest, you know, workmen in a hut somewhere. But that's actually not a bad way to think about defense production in terms of the scale that most of these things operate at. They're very small production by modern defense standards.
that's been my understanding, but the Quincy brief that we were given for this seminar makes the opposite case.
Yeah.
They say Washington has always acted openly or covertly to block such moves and to make sure that European security plans and actions are channeled through the existing NATO command architecture.
Well, so that part, that's the first part, the defense industrial piece, I'd sort of say that's an overstatement. That desire, and again, I think you've worked with this more than I have, that desire to bring it back into the existing NATO structure and in areas where U.S. has a preponderance or a dominance in the policymaking process, I think that's probably actually true, right? And so this mixed message. Stand up, take responsibility,
right.
You know, buy your own weapons, step up, do your part, but check with us first. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't think there's an inherent disconnect there. I think both of those things are simultaneously true. You know, for people who are parents, you want your kids to be independent and strong and powerful, and you'd also like maybe to check with you before taking out loans, right? That's, I'm not sure that's the best metaphor, but this kind of tension is very real. Well, it's like the real world's just kind of like that, right? And so I think it's a case where two things in tension absolutely exist simultaneously, and it doesn't have to be one or the other to be true, right? The only other thing I'll really pull out here, oh, sorry, that was duplication. No decoupling from the US, NATO, the idea, which is, again, an interesting idea in terms of a European strategic autonomy. European strategic defense autonomy, but no decoupling. Along with no duplication. Well, is there a lot of autonomy if there's no decoupling? And then no discrimination against non-EU members of NATO. What I find interesting is that these kind of got laid down as groundwork assumptions of the EU, NATO, or at least the US wanted them to be groundwork assumptions. But they're all problematic, right? How do you live by those principles? And it's noble, you know, you can still find these items today in NATO documentation. One of the things that got laid out as sort of part of this process of a European defense identity in 1992 is, these are known as the Petersburg tasks, Petersburg. Named after the Petersburg Hotel outside Bonn, in which this negotiation happened. And it identifies three or three and a half categories for European military action, security and defense intervention. Humanitarian and rescue tasks. Okay, that's an easy one. Should we be allowed to do humanitarian and rescue tasks? Yes, no problem, done. Peacekeeping tasks. Are you guys clear about the difference between peacekeeping and peacemaking forces, right? Peacekeeping is a permissive environment, or supposed to be a permissive environment. The real world's always messier. In which a third party force usually comes and sits down between two conflicting groups to hold the line, provide a zone of separation, and reduce contact across the line. A whole lot of things get called peacekeeping that aren't really, but the technical definition for this is what they're talking about here. Peacekeeping tasks. Should EU defense forces, drawn from the member states, of course, be allowed to engage in peacekeeping tasks if you're asked? Sure, no problem, easy one. And the third or third and a half section, crisis management, which is a great sort of PR term, right? What does crisis management mean? But explicitly, this including peacemaking tasks, which is a non-permissive intervention between two warring parties, or between a warring party and a civilian population. it is interesting that this is one of the things that was taken on as a legitimate task for EU defense policy. We're not going to go deep into this, but just so you recognize the terminology, you'll see common foreign and security policy and common security and defense policy. CFSP is the overarching area of European Union policy. CSVP is the specifically defense-oriented piece of that. That's terminology that has appeared since 2009, taking over from the old ESDP, European Security and Defense Policy. None of this really matters unless you're trying to get deep into EU institutionalism, but it's another example of the nomenclature changing over time, and it's just important to recognize both, especially if you're looking at older documents. The question of who do you call, who do you pick up the phone and call when you have a security or defense problem, was solved, technically, in 2009 by the creation of the High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, which is also a vice president of the European Commission task. So both titles exist simultaneously for one person. It's two jobs, one office. Anyway, Josep Borrell has been the High Representative and therefore the EU's point person on security and defense since 2019. So if you're the US Secretary of Defense and you have a problem and you need some help, who do you call? You pick up the phone and call Josep Borrell? You call the French defense minister? The German defense minister? The Spanish defense minister? Who's your first call? And herein kind of lies the underlying problem, right? The EU is intentionally designed from the ground up as a deliberative entity. It's not a crisis entity. And they've actually done a much better job over the last year in the Ukrainian context of rapid response than I would have ever imagined possible.
Can I just say one thing, too? One of the things that I was thinking about, because I spent a lot of time in my class talking about how power in different political systems is distributed or how it's structured. When I think about the EU, and I think about the fact that you're thinking about a decentralized system, so to speak. So going back to your question about who do you call on these different issues, it'd be interesting to have that conversation with students about would the EU pivot in a direction to have more centralized power around particular issues, and could that issue be defense and security in the future?
Yep.
We probably have about five minutes.
Probably about time to wrap up. So I'm just going to hit really quickly this transition in European security that may turn out to be game-changing. The Russian invasion, or the, if you prefer, the second Russian invasion of Ukraine, has done more to change this larger topic than I imagined possible. The step up of the Europeans, both in terms of cash, in particular the European Peace Facility, which wasn't created for this purpose, but turns out to have had several billion euros tucked aside for, you know, it's an off-budget item, actually, for strengthening regional and global defense and security. And a tremendous amount of that got transferred to Ukraine straight away, and more has been coming. The extent to which European governments have stepped up, not necessarily particularly quickly, to contribute to Ukraine, that the EU itself has stepped up to contribute to lethal aid, I wouldn't have bet on as quickly as it happened. And the tremendous concern that the US will pull back after the 2024 elections, essentially creating a circumstance in which the Europeans are largely on their own in this process, has brought more motion, more discussion, and more political willingness to take some of these complicated steps, to move away from the three Ds, to duplicate in particular, to duplicate some of these, or start the process of duplicating some of these more complex military capabilities. Have we yet seen the kind of NATO level of integration of militaries from multiple states without NATO at the center of that? That's a longer, slower process. What I'd like to leave you with as we sort of move into Q&A, a brief Q&A because I've talked too long, what's the right approach? How much stepping aside from the NATO structure? How much taking on a willingness to do this themselves, to do it outside a NATO context, to do it without US capabilities? It's all possible. I mean, it can be done. These are some of the richest countries in the world, highly capable, highly technical. Anything they want to do within some limits can happen. Is the political will there? Is the budget there? Is the willingness, presumably eventually, to tell the US, no, we're taking a substantially different approach than you've taken, and you're just going to have to live with it, right? Is all that there? Is it there in sufficient quantity to make something that could reasonably be called a European defense identity? Even if that process started today with full-throated support from the 29 non-North American members of NATO, that's not an instant process. Is it a 10-year process? Is it a 20-year process? How much of the problem of European defense identity is likely to be solved if you drop 10 billion euro over 5 years, 100 billion euro over 10, right? How far, how much, how willing? I think are the big questions.